What I wanted to tell you about today was basically the idea that the four-dimensional space-time that we see our cosmos inhabiting may secretly have extra dimensions, and secretly the higher dimensional space-time might be highly curved. And that in some sense, sort of the chaos really refers to, I'll try and justify it in the talk, but really refers to the fact that in some sense, a mundane, sort of typical, boring setup in this exotic higher dimensional space-time helps to account for special features of the microphysical laws that we see in nature. Okay, so this cartoon will at some point be kind of understood. And but that's the theme of the talk. Okay, so just a quick outline in cartoons, what I'm going to talk about. So I'm talking about extra dimensions, and this is sort of, of course, a quick cartoon of how the extra dimensions are hidden. They fall in some sense. And but as I say, I want to talk about how, if you like, interesting wave functions for the elementary particles of nature. These interesting wave functions with their non-trivial overlaps account for a lot of the observed structures that we see in the fundamental laws of nature when we are unaware of the extra dimensions. Okay? And these interesting wave functions, the fact that they're not all doing the same thing, will be partially related to the fact that the higher dimensional space-time is actually highly curved. The curvature is hidden by the same mechanism that hides the extra dimensions. Towards the end of the talk, I'll also talk about how the higher dimensional nature of space-time leads to interesting questions on the early universe. Here is a typical picture you'll understand later on. And also, perhaps the most immediate thing, is that extra-dimensional excitations may also be things that you can even see in star matter. Okay, so this Large Hadron Collider, which is part of the CERN experimental program outside Geneva, will be one of the things they look for is the signs of extra dimensions within particle collider experiments. So that's one of those. Okay, so let's start. Well, not quite, sorry. One other thing that would be a theme to the talk is from the outside, it certainly looks like extra dimensions are kind of a radical idea. And so they're very exciting to think about and work out all the consequences and so on. But the betting odds are that, you know, nothing that exciting is ever going to happen in our lifetime. But I actually want to, a theme of this talk will also be that this very radical idea is very closely related to a very conservative idea, that small things are made of smaller things. And this is one of the surprising connections that underlies what I have to say. Okay, so I'm saying something, I think, which is much less radical than you might imagine. Okay, so now let's. So, the kind of extra dimension being small, that when I say an extra dimension is small, the idea is, well, let's just ask, what does it mean for a dimension to be finite? And so here, let's, there are no extra dimensions, it's just our universe. And imagine you go in that direction and you hit a wall. Go in another direction and you hit a wall, some sort of mirror on both sides. And but there's nothing out here, so that truly this direction of space is finite. There's no point in talking about what's out here because you cannot, by any physical process, access anything. So you're stuck in this sort of sandwich or parallel plate-like universe here. Okay, so that is certainly the way you get a finite dimension. That would be the level of finite dimension that I will talk about, or compact dimension that I will talk about. Now, we really want to go one dimension up, where, if you like, the long directions, these are the two mirrors in this picture, then these two directions, the vertical, that direction, we want to make that three, and keep just one extra dimension like this. That's the minimal thing we can do, and that's what I'm drawing in the next picture here. So I've added one to these longitudinal directions, if you like, infinite directions, infinite dimensions. I'm just adding one to it. But schematically, I've run out of ways to draw, so schematically, I'm just doing so. The world theorists are doing this is nothing. But let's just then talk about the simplest motion you can have in an extra dimensional universe. Okay? So, the simplest, the interesting thing that's now allowed in an extra dimension, classically, without quantum mechanics, is simply an elementary particle bouncing back and forth in the extra dimension. But the simplest thing is it's not even moving in the usual three dimensions. Okay. Maybe I should name a few things here. These boundaries of space, which are now not two-dimensional boundaries like that wall and this wall, they are actually three-dimensional boundaries, are called three brains. The brain generalizes the word membrane, or you could call it a boundary. Okay. I will typically abbreviate extra dimension to just be XD, and the size of the extra dimension, this length here, or proper length, I'll just call it L, and we're going to assume that it's microscopic in size. Okay. But I want to look at this particle bouncing back and forth, and of course, it carries, because of its kinetic motion, it carries some extra dimensional energy. If, however, this is really microscopic and you're unaware in some sense this is too small for you to see, too small for the naked eye to detect, then the particle looks at rest. It looks at rest in the sense it's not moving in three dimensions, but it does have this extra kinetic energy. And that will therefore, if you're not aware of the fact that it's moving, you would call this extra dimension and this extra dimensional energy a contribution to the rest energy, okay? But in relativity, you know that rest energy is another word for mass. So basically, the effect of a particle doing some huge, you know, moving very rapidly or great energy in the extra dimension is that it would seem to have a bigger mass than you would otherwise expect due to its motion in the extra dimension. So if you're unaware of the extra dimension, that's rule one. Extra dimensional motion translates into what a macroscopic observer would call mass. So why don't we see all of the possible particles, like the electron, having a spread of masses possible? The answer is because quantum mechanics kicks in the very small, and in fact the sort of periodic motion gets quantized, right? And just like in a square well, or similarly to that, you get these kind of simple waveforms, which are the quantum mechanical equivalents of this kinetic bouncing around that I talked about. But of course they're discretized by these boundary conditions in some way. And so we label the different states 0, 2, etc. Okay? And if you work out what the energy spectrum is for a person unaware of these extra dimensions, the energy, remember, the extra dimensional energy translates as some sort of mass that you see as a macroscopic observer, then you find the spectrum of something like this, and the typical spacing between these things is given essentially by dimensional analysis, but here it is, 1 over L. And this is what we mean by a Kaluza-Klein spectrum, that you have decomposed all the possible states you can take in the extra dimension into these guys here, a tower of states, but otherwise no sign of the extra dimension. So a macroscopic person can see this. Now, why don't we see in ordinary experiments all of the spread of masses due to the possible bouncing around in the extra dimension? Well, it's discretized, and if you only have this much energy available, the typical energy of collisions is, say, here, of elementary particles, and you're, say, starting with only these guys, then you can't excite one of these. Okay, so it's hard to do. So typically you stay down here. Now why are you starting? Why is a typical situation to be down here? Because typically nothing stops these higher excitations from decay down to the ground state early on in the history of the universe. And once you're down here, if you don't have high collision energies, you can't excite this. So if this is truly some microscopic extra dimension, then the energy to go up here is more than is typical in a daily event. Okay? So we are mostly this boring person, the guy who's not really sampling the extra dimension in any interesting way, so doesn't really resolve the extra dimension. Therefore, if you need to resolve the extra dimension, you need to have some wiggles in the extra dimension. Otherwise, it doesn't mean anything to you. That costs too much energy. Okay, well, this is the thumbprint of the extra dimension. Okay, so the real problem scientifically is that's nice, you've got the extra dimensions, you've hidden the extra dimensions, and but why did you do it? Okay, by Occam's razor, we should not have done that. And really, the first case I want to make is just that the extra dimensions fit it very nicely into a history of unifications that you're familiar with, that go back in the history of fundamental physics. Here's gravity, and its unifications of gravitational phenomena. Electromagnetism is a great unification. More recently, the unification of electromagnetism and the weak interactions into the electroweak theory is another major unification. The fact that both protons and pions, very different looking things, are made out of the same constituents, quarks and gluons, is a type of unification. And as this process has kept going, we can keep being more and more ambitious. More and more of the fundamental forces be linked in some way to a unification. Where do extra dimensions feature in that? Well, first, I don't want to go into great detail. I at least want to say, why is it, I think extra dimensions have some natural power for unification. Okay. And you can see it pretty much by just studying what a vector looks like in extra dimensions, higher dimensions. So here are three dimensions, again, drawn as a plane. And I've drawn this axis to be an extra-dimensional direction. And here is some typical vector, and it has two types of components. You can resolve its components into a 3D component and an extra-dimensional component. Now, if you do a 3D rotation, this component rotates. This component does not. So basically, this is a scalar. And so, for example, if you take some vector as part of making a theory of electromagnetism, you have some vector potential in some higher dimensional version of the theory, you would not only get three-dimensional electromagnetism at long distances by ending up with this mode here, the lowest mode. Low energies or long distances, you end up with this mode, and so any higher dimensional theory looks effectively like a 3+1 dimensional theory. You certainly get that. Higher dimensional electromagnetism does reduce to standard electromagnetism. But it also gives you a scalar. And the scalar has some special properties because it is the cousin of, it's just another component of the same fundamental object. In fact, this is something that was used very early on in the history of relativity. A more modern application is applying the scalar to be something as exotic as the Higgs boson, something as useful as the Higgs boson of particle physics. We'll talk a little bit about that later. Of course, there's a famous higher version of this. I don't know how to draw tensors, but this is a vector. And you can imagine when you do tensors to describe higher dimensional general relativity, you at long distances or low energies, you recover macroscopically 3+1 dimensional general relativity. But you also recover again some extra components which give you 3+1 dimensional Maxwell theory. At least in a certain type of compactification, you do obtain that. Of course, again, this is the original idea that goes back to Goulson Klein and some details. But basically, when you apply this very simple mechanism in the most straightforward ways, this kind of this is a tremendous unification, of course, right? Gravity and non-gravitational force, but the details are all wrong. Tell you how to quickly realize that after the talk, but let me just say the details are all wrong, but there's something wrong. So let me keep talking about the unifications that might involve extra dimensions. So the other one I want to talk about is grand unification. So we have electromagnetism and the weak interactions already unified in a tested spring that was experimentally tested electroweak interactions, part of the standard model. And then you have the strong interactions described by quantum chromodynamics. But you can try and ask whether there's one step further, and there are very strong hints that really the electroweak interactions, the strong interactions, could be unified into some mother force of random unified theory. And then the question is, well, why do we actually see them as three quite different types of phenomena, three very different force fields? And one of the, this is not the original way it was said, but one of the simplest ways of realizing why a unified force should have three different aspects that look so different is because the unification is taking place in a higher dimensional theory. So in some higher dimensional space-time, there are truly, all of these forces are part of just some unified force with many component force fields. And the boundary conditions on these boundaries of the extra dimension somehow distinguish the different component force fields. Okay, so they just don't respect, they don't respect this equal treatment of all forces that the mother force would suggest. They actually make this distinction. And so what you get macroscopically is something that really sees different forces but has some memory, and we'll talk about that memory, of its unified origins from higher dimensions. Okay. So this is the version of grand unification called orbital unification. But it's a very attractive way of doing it. It's one of the simplest ways of ironing out many of the wrinkles, the technical wrinkles in the idea of gravitation. Okay, so the last sort of conventional motivation is this approach to quantum gravity, string theory, which attempts to reconcile general relativity and quantum mechanics. But again, string theory is famous for the fact that while trying to reconcile these two ingredients, which is the hard problem, is a spin-off. It appears to naturally give rise to other forces, the kind of force, the gauge forces, the kind of forces that we do see in nature. But it also seems to give rise to extra dimensions, quite typical string structure. And so that's another reason why you might take extra dimensions seriously. Plus, string theory has actually given us stringy versions of all of the previous mechanisms. In fact, some of them were really discovered within the string context. So these are the conventional motivations. In fact, the one that that I think is the closest to the spirit of this talk is really what I would call emergent extra dimensions, and maybe is the most surprising of the lot, because we don't put the extra dimensions in, we get them out. And the various words attached to this in more technical language are ADS-CFT, correspondence, or holography. But let me try and explain what's going on. This is the spectrum of a, I'm being sloppy in the drawing, this is the spectrum of a standard theory with some bound states. For example, the hydrogen spectrum looks a bit like this. But up here, you get into the continuum of the ionized states, right? But if you have a confining theory, like QCD is a confining theory, if you have a confining theory where you can't pull the quarks apart, the constituents apart from each other, you can't ionize. When you don't have ionization, then in some sense, this discrete nature can keep going, okay? So that's why I put the word strong, in some sense, strongly bound states. This is not, this is what you'd expect. The energy spectrum of particles, all down states would look like this. On the other hand, I just showed you a second ago, a few minutes ago, that this is the spectrum, something qualitatively like this, is the spectrum of Kaluza-Klein states. For a macroscopic observer, they would see this energy spectrum of states. Okay? Now, what's so surprising is, that sometimes the physics, not only is the spectrum just schematically similar, but that the physics is sometimes equivalent. That is, experimentally, you can't distinguish. A theorist can write things in this language or in this language, but there's no experiment that can actually distinguish these two sides. On some occasion, there are pairs of theories of that sort. That is incredible. That's what we'd say, well, I was trying to write a theory of quantum dynamics, and it turns out it has some extra dimensions in it. They walk into, you know, the states seem to walk and talk like extra dimensional excitations, and we call that emergent extra dimensions. Okay. So that's the statement. Now let me try and make it even barely plausible that a miracle of this sort could occur. Yes?
Yeah. How much of the time when this happens, is there a scaling, and is the scaling which is governing the bound states of the strongly interacting theory, and that scaling dimension in some sense is the extra dimension?
In all the examples, no. Okay, all the examples.
I'm sorry,
so in fact, you're anticipating maybe the next thing, which is, in some sense, energy space is Fourier transformed from our insane, which is a position space. So can I just show you a picture? And so here's the picture to try and explain how could it possibly be that some strong dynamics, which has no extra dimensions in it, can walk and talk like an extra dimensional theory. And that in some sense, a person living in that made out of a theory would identify themselves with this side. So that requires you to look at my picture, mother and child, or sisters, okay? So what is this a picture of? You see, it could be a mother and child. Here is some smaller version of this person here, right? So they could be mother and child. But, of course, they could also be twins, and just one of them is standing further back from the other, right? And so there seems to be some degeneracy in how we take this picture in. Of course, we can easily break this degeneracy. We say, look, if I just look at one atom inside this person here, if this is in fact a picture of mother and child, then an atom inside the mother should be the same size as an atom inside the child. So clearly, since the atoms are looking scaled out, this is literally similar to this, this must be a picture of sisters. And this is actually meant to be a picture of a 3D story. Child is becoming a mother. However, what if the dynamics of nature was such that the hydrogen atom, the size of an atom, if I give you an atom of a certain size, or radius or whatever, that there's another atom, exactly the same shape, same orbital size, shapes, but it's just bigger. Okay, so what we know that that's not true in the real world. There is a characteristic size for atoms. But you could imagine in some dynamics, which is scaling, where if you give me a structure of a certain size, I can create something literally similar to it, just bigger or smaller, and it has the same shape, etc. So then it would really be ambiguous whether this atom here might literally just be a shrunken version of this atom, and in fact, they really are mother and child. That is, this is really, they're both sitting there on the page, not one behind the other, they're on the page, and this is just a miniaturized version of this person. Then it turns out you really would have a hard time figuring out whether this is a 3D reality or a 2D reality. And in fact, you might imagine you could just about fake it completely. Okay. Now we need to bump that up by one dimension. If this is a 3 plus 1 dimensional screen which has scale invariant physics, right? There's a sector of the laws of nature which is scale invariant physics, then it would fake this extra dimensional illusion. Okay? And that would be one way of imagining how emergent extra dimensions would take place. Now, sounds like a good plan at cartoon level, but does it actually happen? And what's remarkable is how simple an example, that is, how simple a departure from theories that we have already tested experimentally, manages to realize this plot. Okay? That is, there is a cousin of QCD, quantum chromodynamics, the theory of strong interactions, strong nuclear interactions, where you just, one of the things you have to do is generalize the fact that quantum chromodynamics has 3 colors for quarks. Instead, you have to take a large number of colors for quarks. But basically, it's a theory where, unlike the strong interactions, which have a characteristic size for bound states, roughly the Fermi, the femtometer scale or so, that this cousin happens to be a scale invariant theory. Okay, so that's ingredient number one. And in fact, there's a very strong set of pieces of evidence to say that this theory, by this ambiguity, is in fact a 5-dimensional, Watson talks like a five-dimensional theory in space-time, the theory of a five-dimensional space-time. Not only that, the space-time is curved, in the sense that it is, looks like anti-de Sitter space in five dimensions. It's infinite five-dimensional space-time, in the simplest example. And what's remarkable is while this theory is just some cousin of strong nuclear interactions, it makes no mention about gravity. It's all phrased in Minkowski space. This dual theory in five-dimensional space is a theory of quantum gravity. Okay? And there's some evidence to suggest that it's a string theory. String theory. So that is off-scale amazing. Unfortunately, I have nothing to do with it. Okay, but that is underlying the interesting story I want to tell you. That's the version of motivation for extra dimensions that actually is the case. So really, the story I'm telling you is one where strong interactions in a four-dimensional, purely 3+1-dimensional setting plays the starring role, but in some sense, your calculations, the way the theory walks and talks is a higher dimensional space-time.
The way that you phrase the argument, it makes sense, and I mean, it makes very, very good sense, but it's not, the way that you made the argument, it's not clear that the five-dimensional geometry has to be dynamical. Indeed, it seems the opposite, that the five-dimensional geometry is fixed by being related to scale invariance of the four-dimensional theory, which then would answer one of the big weaknesses of all the higher dimensional theories, which is why isn't there as much dynamics going on in the higher dimensions messing things up as there are in the four dimensions. So I mean, if I just follow the words, it seems like you point to a situation where you have a five-dimensional world, but where the geometry of the fifth dimension is frozen by the duality from being really a scaling transformation.
So, in fact, the reason that we know that it's a quantum gravity theory on the five-dimensional side is we can work this ambiguity out, not for a woman, but actually for a very particular state that you can make in the scale invariant dynamics, like the QCD-like theory. And that state is any of these field quantum field theories has an energy momentum tensor. Mm-hmm. And we can act on it, we can use it and apply it to the vacuum. And it creates some state made out of gluons, this theory. This thing, if you follow very carefully, but it's worth saying, which is if you follow very carefully what this is dual to in the higher dimensional picture, you find, because this is roughly a spin 2 operator, that it's dual to some spin 2 particle in 5D. But what's so surprising is the fact that this is a conserved energy momentum tensor turns out to say that the 5D mass of this particle is zero. So it's a massless spin 2 particle in five dimensions. And in fact, with some extra pieces of information, as you probably know, massless spin 2 is halfway to general coordinate number. So basically, the picture you build up, the evidence is that there are gravitons in the theory. And so you, in some sense, have a fixed background, but with fluctuations, at least the small ones, don't ask me about large ones, which make being general relativity expanded around a certain background. Okay, now, I just want to explain, since you are a bunch of theorists, there's one thing that I think is really beautiful about this story. You see, this fake extra dimension, you know, it's so easy to create extra dimension, use temperature as an extra dimension, who cares? What makes an extra dimension worth talking about in the modern world is relativity and rotational invariance. Okay, the fact that this fake direction, the depth direction I'm creating here, is that really physically equivalent to, say, this direction on the page, which seems to have quite a different footing in the story I just told? Or are there boosts that can take this depth direction in the direction of time, okay? So is there a Lorentz transformation between the depth direction that emerged? Is there really something that magical? Surely you're not saying something that magical. But you are, okay? And that, I just want to say a few words. So, a theory of scale invariance, well, what is it? It's a theory which certainly you would say, I'm taking for granted that the theory has ordinary 3 plus 1 dimensional Lorentz invariance, this needle type of invariance. Of course, it has translation invariance along the page, okay, the 3 plus 1 dimensional space time. And it has scale invariance, because that's the plot, right? That's the story of understanding the cartoon bubble. However, the fact that theories of this sort, the kind that we're talking about, are also local. There is an action governing them, if you like, and the action is the integral of some local events, couplings that happen in definite. There's no action in this as well. There's a very strong conjecture. It's a theorem in 1 plus 1 dimension, but it's a very strong conjecture, with no exceptions known, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, that there is a magical accidental symmetry beyond these. That when you ask for these, you get something that you didn't bargain for. And that's this symmetry, which you would never, I would never have thought of unless I had been told in advance. Okay? This is really bizarre, that a theory which just enjoys these symmetries, plus it has some sort of locality and it doesn't have action in the distance calculus, has this symmetry. Now, it turns out that this symmetry, added to this list, is what gives you the sort of the Lorentz invariance in the five-dimensional sense, that the emergent dimension is equivalent to the others in the sense that it can be boosted and rotated into the others, and that's a symmetry of the dynamics in the illusory higher-dimensional space. I put the quotes on Lorentz because this is really anti-de Sitter space. Okay.
What is the conjecture?
Oh, the conjecture is that with sort of this statement of locality of the interactions, that if you have all of these invariances, that you automatically have this invariance. Okay, that this is not something you demand. But if you have this, it's called, then the full set is called conformal field theory that has all of these properties. So the statement, the conjecture is a scale invariant field theory is a conformal field theory.
If you want to have a closed algebra, then fourth point should be added to the first three ones.
Yeah, they would close by themselves. So this is something, this is not a trivial thing. That's why it's not a proof, because it's not a trivial group theoretic closure statement that this thing is required. It's for a deeper reason than
okay, so it's not required, but
it's not required by group theory. But quantum field theory has more structure than just the group theory out. So that's why you never think it off the top. You'd have to see something about quantum field, the nature of quantum field theory.
And the first three lines are four-dimensional, and the x squared at the bottom is four-dimensional x squared?
This is also four-dimensional. Yeah, everything here is stated at 4D level. It's the prerequisites of the 4D theory to get this magic in 5D.
So when you say conjecture, it means that people looked at field theories that have top three invariances are local, and they always find the bottom one.
Yes.
Comes out.
Yes, and there's kind
and
of
there's
a pseudo
no exceptions.
Exactly. And there are no known exceptions. There's a pseudo proof where you say, look, it was pretty damn close to a proof. And then there's just some little wiggle room. And then that proof actually is a proof in 1 plus 1 dimensions, as it turns out. So that's the level at which we understand.
So in 1 plus 1, it's a theorem.
In 1 plus 1, it's a theorem.
And in more than 1 plus 1, it's a conjecture. And is it a conjecture for any dimension?
That's almost certainly true. Almost certainly true. But you're going beyond my expertise. Okay, so what I want to talk about is this again, going back to the idea of extra dimensions. Here is this sort of extra dimension here, and this plane is meant to represent three dimensions, even though I'm only drawing two. And the reason that it's looking a bit warped in this sense is because I'm trying to talk about this idea of warped. And roughly, this picture is coming out of solving the higher dimensional Einstein's equations in a fairly robust choice of the Einstein action plus some cosmological constant it's really trying to solve what you would call the parallel plate capacitor, the boundaries of space-time on the plates. And you're trying to solve, but not for electric fields, but for gravitational field. And you find a very simple solution, which I'll tell you in a second. I'm just drawing it as a cartoon here, and saying in some sense, there's space grows. I mean, this four-dimensional, 3+1-dimensional planes are growing in the extra dimension. And really, the analog is just the picture of an expanding universe. Every time slice, every instant in time, could be, in our case, in our universe, it is a flat space. Every slice of space is flat. But in some sense, the space is growing as time evolves. We call that an expanding universe, which is a type of space-time curvature. But a curvature that you can't see if you just cut and look at the spatial slice. You need to see the space-time evolution to see it. And in particular, there's the idea of inflation, which is, by some strong circumstantial evidence nowadays, which is exponential expansion of space and time. Well, this solution here is exponential expansion of four-dimensional space-time as a function of the fifth dimension. Okay, that's the solution. And so why is that interesting? First is, it's interesting because it's a very robust type of solution that occurs in this context. And the second is because of, I'll explain it. Yeah, this is, I'll save this for those, well, probably all of you. So the geometry in particular is of this form. The vacuum of the theory, the vacuum solution, looks like a geometry where there is the fifth dimensional coordinate y. It goes from between 0 and L, and it's just y is just proper distance. Then this part of the geometry in any particular, if you fix y, and you look at any particular 3+1-dimensional slice, it looks just like Minkowski spacetime. Okay, that's the Minkowski metric. Minus, plus, 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 or whatever. But there is this factor, this exponential factor, which changes as a function of where you are in the extra dimension. And that's the Warp factor, which is the analog of the scale factor of ordinary cosmology. And the rate at which the e-foldings change is what's called the radius of curvature, and that's some constant r. Okay, so this is the solution you find. What's interesting is that when this is a solution, then automatically you know the long wavelength gravitational fields. Okay? The long wavelength gravitational field that a macroscopic person would observe, unaware of the extra dimensions, they would secretly be sampling this kind of, this is how the macroscopic field would look. It would, of course, be a function only of four-dimensional space-time, because we're unaware, apparently, should be unaware of the extra dimensions. But this will be the way macroscopic fields behave. It will be rigid in any other sense. You could certainly write some more complicated looking function of g of x and y and so on and so on. But this will be what is macroscopically allowed, and there's a sort of quick reason why you know to guess this based on this being a solution. The reason is because any metric, four metric like this, g, v, u of x, is, as you know, by the equivalence principle or whatever, it is locally equivalent to flat space. Okay? Gravitational field, locally, there's an inertial reference frame in which there is no gravity, and that's the statement here, which means that this solution, this form, this ansatz here, is locally at x, coordinate equivalent to this thing up here, this solution up here. If this is a solution, that means this is nearly a solution. So this is at long wavelengths, these modes are easy to excite. And so these are the this g v u of x is what a long wavelength observer calls the gravitational field. What's interesting is really the fact that this gravitational field, in some sense, is not in the extra dimension, it is over, sort of leaning over to one side of the extra dimension as described by this scale factor.
How do you know that the Einstein equations 4D was satisfied with no matter there and matter there. You have to check that.
So you mean, so let's do the simplest thing. No matter, and you just want to check, say, nonlinear solutions of Einstein's equations. Is that what you mean?
Yes. Well, I'm just wondering if you have if you have matter.
If you have matter, then you have to ask where you're going to put it. But if the matter is well separated, so it's just a source. So outside that source, then it's sort of pure Einstein theory or something. Then you're still guaranteed this is what you have. So if there's some localized sources, the star or something like that. Outside that, this is the gravitational field. That's still true. It's still a very good approximation, even inside the star, but that's not meant to be totally obvious. But at least outside the star, this matter, and this is the thing that dominates that long wave. Yeah.
Is there a precise statement of the form of take a set of metrics which are asymptotically flat across this crunching factor, warp factor, and compute the ADM energy in the appropriate 4+1-dimensional sense, and demonstrate that there are massless modes which are all four-dimensional, and then there's a mass gap before
yes.
the five-dimensional geometry.
Yes, yes. There is a mass gap. These are the massless modes, so-called zero modes. And then any other mode you write down would be a would have a gap in the frequency. I'm speaking classically, audience. But there's a gap. These things can have arbitrarily low frequency, and then there's a gap before you hit the next mode. Any other mode that's not written down here. So in quantum mechanics, you would say that is massive. Okay, what good, so again, who cares that gravitational field is leaning over to one side? Well, you can do this for all the particles. You can see how, you write their field equation, but you see what tendencies do you find. You don't get a choice, to some extent, but to some extent there are parameters in play with it, but to some extent there are not. They're in some sense blocked. And the reason is that why is this interesting? Because these tendencies to lean one way or another give rise to what I'll call warped hierarchies. That is, ultimately, the very different wave functions, if you think particle by particle, you don't say the field is leaning one way, you say the wave function for every graviton in the field is leaning to one side. That these wave functions, and they're very different wave functions, and the overlaps, that is the probability that a particle with this wave function can find a particle like this to interact with, these give rise to sort of exponential suppressions in the probabilities for various processes, microphysical processes, to go. And these kind of hierarchies seem to be very, very reminiscent of what we actually see in nature. Okay. Let me try to make that case. Here is this graviton, the purple line, leaning over to one side. Okay? That happens to be, therefore, not different. Nay, the UV brain or the planet brain. What you find is that, for example, all of the force carriers that are not gravity tend to have this flat profile, as if they don't even notice that it's warped space-time. Then the fermions of nature, like the top quark and the electron, are very sensitive to parameters in their equations of motion and can lean one way or the other dramatically. That's not true. You don't have, it's not possible for, say, the photon or the graviton that you have locked in tests. But basically, this is the typical picture. And the Higgs particle, which is what I'll spend a little time talking about, leans, again, you have no choice. It leans rather robustly to one side, the opposite side from the ground. So there are these tendencies. Who cares? Well, let's see. Let's just focus on these two things. The Higgs, okay, and I'll tell you how to think about that, and the graviton. Well, one of the major hierarchy problems say, why should we explain hierarchy? Because it's a problem, it's a puzzle. And the quickest way to say it is that gravity is incredibly weak, as measured at sort of, it's not that Bangladesh is poor, it's per capita, it's each person. So gravity looks plenty strong in this room. On the other hand, per elementary particle, gravity is weak in the sense that you compare, say, a top quark, this electric force between two top quarks versus the gravitational force between two top quarks, and you find this very tiny factor. That's just a, okay, that's the way the world came out, except that when you look at quantum corrections, the quantum corrections to this 10 to the minus 30 that you actually see are kind of order one and messy. There's no particular pattern that we see. Somehow they all add up to 10 to the minus 30. And that is what's called the hierarchy problem. In fact, it's hard to swallow that amazing thing happened, but that's the conclusion you would get in the Stanford problem. Okay, so the first thing to do in trying to understand this mystery is to understand this gravitational force I'm talking about. If I have two top quarks, which are the heaviest particles in the Standard Model, and I say, well, they're so heavy that the gravitational force is maximized for any elementary particles, and I still get this tiny number. But why? What sets the scale of elementary particle masses? And it turns out that the Standard Model, the structure of the Standard Model is that in some sense, at the beginning, you are forced to think of all the elementary particles of the Standard Model as masses traveling at the speed of light. Nothing is done, they would travel at the speed of light. Okay? But something has to be done because they are not observed to travel at the speed of light. And that requires this Higgs condensate. The whole idea of this Higgs is it's a kind of ether that you must have in what you think of as the vacuum. It must really be some sort of ether, but it must be all the usual tests. So it has to be some sort of Lorentz invariant ether, which is the same in any reference frame. And its job is that the elementary particles of the Standard Model, as they propagate through the ether, slow down below light speed, and hence they have some mass. Okay? It is needed for the sort of consistency we have of the Standard Model that this is the way that mass is generated in the Standard Model. So these tiny masses giving rise to the tiny force of gravity are coming about via this moving in the Higgs condensate. Okay. Now, why are these masses so small is the question. It's hierarchy problem question. And the warped compactification picture answers it by saying that quite robustly, the Higgs condensate is sort of localized at this other side of the extra dimension, not where the graviton is. And if you look here, you see that where the graviton lives near y equals 0, this warp factor is about 1. Forget it. So the graviton says Minkowski space is Minkowski space. Okay. On the other hand, where the Higgs condensate lives, wants to live, as a solution to this equation of motion, this thing is e to the minus 2 L extra dimensions over R, which is also Minkowski space, but in some weird units. Okay, because this is not 1, 1, 1. This is, e to the minus something. Now, if you rescale the units so that we can talk to our experimentalists, what you find is that the natural scale for the masses, once you do the rescaling of units, is that the masses are rescaled by this warp factor where the Higgs condensate lives. So that the masses are naturally, they're sort of, if everything in the higher dimensional theory was chosen, where all scales were chosen comparably, they vary by factors of 10 or something like that, you can exponentiate these results. For example, even if L and R are comparable, 30 apart, you could account for this this kind of hierarchy, simply because the masses would be very small. And hence, Newton's law, the force between two top quarks, say, given by G. Newton, and remember, gravity does not see any weird form factor, But these masses appearing in Newton's law are feeling this form factor. And so there's naturally an exponential coming from the geometry of space-time, which weakens the force of gravity. But that sounds like an awful lot to do to manage to explain why this is small. But it happens to be a way of doing it, which is even after you put in quantum corrections on top of the story, said in a very classical way, it still works. And it turns out that it's only one of maybe less than a handful of robust mechanisms we know that can actually account in a natural way for this feature.
Do you think the value of an extra dimension?
So you're not able to say, you're not saying, look, I predict L over R is blah, blah, blah. What you can show is that L over R is very naturally numbers of order 1, certainly, 10, okay, several. All your, but it's a parameter. Ultimately, that's a parameter, the ratio of L over R. But what you do see is that there's a mechanism which exponentiates even modest hierarchies to make them enormous hierarchies. And that mechanism is protected against quantum corrections. That's the only thing you're buying. But you're not buying a prediction for L over R, because nobody has a way of predicting. So it's an info. So let me explain a little bit about the chaos on the borders. You see, in some sense, look. This picture is actually not just typical of some fit I've done to the standard model to make sure the standard model emerges macroscopically from this picture. This picture is actually typical of you take a gauge theory of gravity and you just throw it into this warp factorization, and you just choose one at random and watch what it does. If you work out its long wavelength consequences, it will look a little bit like the kind of structures that we see in the standard model. The standard model would look like some typical case of doing this.
Sorry, Rama, can I, before you move on, sir, can I ask, so if I have, doesn't it say that I'm very sensitive, the gravitational field I will feel in my brain is very sensitive to whatever stuff is living on the UV frame? Because the stuff living there is not exponentially suppressed.
It's not, no.
So it has to be an empty brain on the other side of the universe?
No, in the sense that you will only feel, if the stuff on the other brain is charged under, say, the photon, then you're absolutely right. You'll just feel it. Because you see, this photon wave function just goes straight across. It has no problem going from one end to the other. If it's not charged, say, in principle, the stuff on the other brain may only couple to you through gravity. And it would just be some dark matter. See. So it wouldn't be that easy to see. There was enough of it which had decayed away.
Yeah. But doesn't it couple to us where the strength much stronger than what we infer in the strength of gravity?
No, because the strength of gravity, if you like, G Newton. In some sense, there are no exponentials because gravity lives over where in the way I've written the theory. The warp factor is 1. In some sense, the G Newton you get is the G Newton, roughly speaking, the G Newton you put into the five-dimensional theory. There's no exponentials between you and it. So everybody sees this. It's the mask in the way I'm explaining it. There are many equivalent physical theoretical descriptions of the same physics, but when I'm explaining it, it's the masks that are changed. So in some sense, the natural masking for particles living on the opposite brain from the Higgs constant is M Planck. Many, many orders of magnitude heavier than the protons. That's the natural scale. Of course, they could also be 0. Although there might be some other mechanism. Some hierarchy.
Yeah. Then, if only gravity is the leading unit 2, gravity is attractive, so won't you expect the L exponential becomes 0?
There are in fact forces that can act on that can pull it together or push it apart. Think of other considerations. So really, one of the things that I haven't talked about, but is an, I would say, is an elegant part of the story, is the stabilized, you know, what you want is at least in the present day, you want some spring that really does this, right? So you're robust against all of those effects. That's the physics of the spring. The simplest version of that is called the Goldberg-Wise mechanism. And I think what's nice is that it's a very elegant, simple story, which does not require you to introduce any, again, very large, very small parameters or hierarchies in the fundamental theory. That is, all I'm selling you here is an exponential mechanism, okay, which is robust against quantum events. Without, of course, you don't want to then put in exponentials by hand, but you say, the Goldberg-Wise mechanism, the mechanism that creates the spring and allows L to be a little bit bigger than R, is an elegant mechanism. Justify that afterwards. There is a spring mechanism. I'm taking it for granted. Okay, so as far as the non-gravitational force fields, again, just to back up this word, in some sense, everything that you could pretty much think of is actually realized in a realistic model. It's like, well, what about these boundary conditions? You never said anything about boundary conditions. You have two boundaries. Well, what could they be? I'm just giving a cartoon. Neumann, Neumann, Dirichlet, 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 Neumann, Neumann, Dirichlet. And each one of them has some interesting features. So Neumann, Neumann will make these, you know, the photons and so on and so on, will mediate long-range forces. That's good. Dirichlet, Dirichlet will give rise to actually scalar fields, the extra-dimensional components, being giving rise to long-range or light particles, things like axions. Dirichlet-Neumann, in some ordering of these brains, gives rise to short-range forces. Dirichlet-Neumann will give rise to conservation laws, like the fact that protons don't decay for some reason, proton number. Baryon number, proton plus neutron number, seems to be conserved in nature. So many of these things, all of them seem to have played some little role in a realistic model.
Are there boundary conditions in one brain or in two brains?
There's a boundary condition on that brain, and there's a boundary condition on that brain. They have no reason to be correlated.
So
there's no symmetry.
So there is nothing between these two, for example. And a string that ends in one boundary.
A string that ends in one boundary goes to the other would be incredibly massive. First sight, there's no reason for it to be stable. But yeah, so I'm just doing particles.
So for each of the fields of your theory, you choose the appropriate boundary conditions that give you the kind of phenomenon you want, or?
Exactly. So what is actually done? We're building a model, we're trying to build a model. So, say this here, there's various things you have to get right about the real world. So you do it. You choose the boundary conditions you need. But then you stand back and you look at it. You say, oh, so I see that what I've got is some incredibly special looking theory in this higher dimensional space-time. Or you say, wow, it just looks like everything that could happen, happened. And that sort of accounts for the way the world works. And it looks to me more like the latter. That it, after I fit it, it just looks like some typical example of throwing a dart at the parameter space. And you've got some.
But ostensibly, at the level of explaining the different fields, you basically have to tell in theory what boundary conditions you want to get the field you want.
So your power of explanation is a little bit more qualitative. That there are these tendencies, maybe, you know, that this is actually a good example of the one I skipped, which is the fact that the masses of spin half elementary particles is rather hierarchical itself, very different mass from the top quark, is actually correlated in the standard model. There's a mechanism called the Gym mechanism, which is just there for free. Nobody asked for it in the construction of the standard model. That is there in the experiments, too, where species-changing transitions, where, you know, down quark transitions into a strange quark, for example. Processes like that are very tightly related. The rate at which they go are related to how similar different species are in mass. That pattern, there's some sort of a pattern we see both experimentally and in the standard model, is a very easy pattern. When you go beyond the standard model, it's a very easy pattern to lose, to screw up. Whereas this fermion wave function, the way they sort of, the way you account for these masses, that is, the tendency of fermions, wave functions to overlap with the Higgs condensate, and species-changing transitions, in this context, automatically keeps this qualitative link that we see in the data. It didn't have to be that way. We didn't know the priori check. So there are some qualitative features where it just seems to be going in the right direction when it could have in principle gone in the wrong direction. And imagine if the Higgs condensate and the graviton wanted to do the same stuff. They wanted to do the same. But they don't. So it's a bit qualitative. Of course, you have enough parameters to then fit to the real world exactly. That you're not getting for free. You're not explaining the electron mass. So I just want to say the thing is, realistic models have been built along these lines, and that's not trivial because we have a lot of different types of evidence. In some sense, the evidence is more and more direct. We really think there really is dark matter. We really have done some set of collider searches, done some studies that led us to this present point. And in some sense, this is the thing called virtuality of evidence. We have some prejudices as well. It's way up here. And each of these things probe higher amount of energies as we get more and more speculative. But these are considerations. We would ideally not like to go afoul of any of these considerations, where we do, say, precision tests which probe higher scales using the Heisenberg uncertainty principle than we actually have energy to produce the colliders. What's exciting is just at this electroweak unification scale, the scale typical of the Higgs condensate, we are now going to decisively probe the Large Hadron Collider. And that story is very closely related to the story I've just been telling you about extra dimensions in the following sense. Because the Large Hadron Collider and also the Teletron and Fermilab are, you know, their main line of business is, well, every field in the field, in quantum field theory, is associated to a particle. So it's Higgs condensate, is some sort of ether, just like there are photons in quantum theory, there are Higgs particles. Because Higgs condensate has a Higgs particle. And that's the missing link of electroweak unification. You see all the evidence that there's an ether, but we've never produced the Higgs particle, fermion. And the first line of business of these big colliders is to produce it. How do you do that? You bang the two constituents of protons into each other, and they can fuse and form a Higgs boson, Higgs particle, which can then decay. You can look for these decay products and establish salts. But in a theory where warped compactifications are at the core of why gravity is weak, okay, then there should be these, not just the lightest, not just the lowest energy modes of each species. I've drawn the wave functions here of the lowest energy modes of each species. You should also have the wiggly modes, okay, the more energetic or more massive wiggly modes. It turns out, almost regardless of species, they all tend to lean over here, okay? And therefore, they all tend to have masses typical of the elementary, like the top particles. They all tend to have wave functions roughly, crudely leaning sort of in the same way as the top quark. So they have masses which are in the, you know, a little bit bigger than the top quark mass. And so not only should you be able to produce the Higgs boson, which also has a mass somewhere in the top quark mass range, you should also be able to produce these extra-dimensional wiggly modes. So here I'm drawing the extra dimension. I can't draw warping at the same time. It's too busy otherwise. But basically, you have the n equals zero modes, the lightest modes of any species, say some quarks inside a proton. And you're going to collide them. And their wave functions are sort of flat or boring. Maybe they're not flat, but they're just, they're not very interesting in the X dimension. And you're going to bang them together. Why? Because that infuses a lot of energy, the energy of the colliding protons. And you can convert that into the mass of the Kaluza-Klein excitation, which, remember, is that means you're taking kinetic energy in this direction and turning it into kinetic energy in the extra dimension. Okay, that's the game plan, and there's some amplitude. And so you do this, and for a brief while, you produce, say, an excited Kaluza-Klein gluon, which in quantum mechanics is some wiggly thing exploring the extra dimension. And then it decays into, say, top, anti-top quarks, which are, again, equal zero modes. And you look for that. And so there's a whole rich phenomenology of this kind of process. Say, hey, you've actually seen this mechanism at work. The only catch is that this picture I'm drawing here, really, in real experiments, would look more like this. That is, not only would you be producing this n equals 1 excited Kaluza-Klein mode, you would also be producing far more n equals 0 mode. So basically, there's lots of background that you're looking for. And you have to put on your Polaroid glasses to sort of get rid of all that junk you don't want to see and see this. And the choice of words is apt in the sense that, for example, this Kaluza-Klein gluon search that I drew a picture of, has been studied, and one of the clever tricks for trying to get rid of all this background is actually to use the top quark polarization. So you see, you end up with top quarks as one of the final distinct final states here, and you look at the polarization of these top quarks. They have a spin, so it's polarization, and you look at that as a way of cutting out a lot of this background stuff that's obscuring your view. Similarly, you can look at unification. I mean, what happens if you take one of these warp setups and put in the unified theory, a unified force field here? And there's a remarkable thing that, again, didn't have to happen, because it actually required putting experimental numbers in and seeing, which is we know that forces fall off like 1 over r squared, at least in some regime. And if we multiply by r squared, then they should just be constants, one for each force. And you can look at them as a function of distance. You can sort of measure the distances we do measure at and put in the experimental values. And you can see, as a result of purely quantum mechanical effects, these constants are run. That is, there are logarithmic modulations of these constants. And you can see you can extrapolate what happens to them at very, very small distances. And if this picture is true, then the memory that these forces should have of their mother is that these strengths of the forces should unify. And remarkably, they do. For those who know supersymmetric, it's a coincidence. Similarly, I'm sorry, I'm well over time, so I'll just race through this. Again, akin to theories of supersymmetry, this kind of unification also has a sort of natural dark matter candidate. There is a certain type of Kaluza-Klein excitation that if the proton can't decay, then this Kaluza-Klein excitation can't decay either, can't get rid of it that easily. And naturally, if you calculate its sort of relic abundance, how much of it is around, if it was thermally produced in the universe, you find that it is in the ballpark of the dark matter abundance we need. And there, again, a phenomenology of looking for it, either in the LHC, trying to produce it at the LHC, or doing more conventional dark matter detection experiments. I won't talk about this because I'm over time. It's important. I do want to say this. This is kind of cute. It's just, so what happens in the early universe? This is the picture of what happens in the early universe. And it's very interesting when you heat up a warped quantification. Because when you heat it up enough, this UV brain is the end in which the graviton lives. Okay, it's more UV. But the other end, where the Higgs condensate lives, gets swallowed up behind a black hole horizon. So this is not a black hole, this is a black ring. It's a three-dimensional curve. So this is where the IR brain would have been. But at high temperature, this is what you get instead. And as the and in this state, because of the presence of this graviton that's still there, the universe keeps expanding in the big directions. And as it expands, this horizon recedes further away from this brain. And eventually, at zero temperature, roughly where we are now, you would like the IR brain to sort of peek through and to come out. Okay. But you know that's an odd thing to ask, something to come out of a horizon, black hole horizon. But it's just got to happen. It's got to happen. So what you want is for this to happen. You want the emergence of this brain from the black hole, coming out of the black hole horizon, to get like this. And of course, when you're in this state, the Higgs condensate is hidden. So electroweak interactions are not separate, they are unified. After it has come out, the electroweak theory, the electromagnetism and the weak interactions are sort of separate, treated separately, because the Higgs condensate effectively gives you boundary conditions that treats them separately. So this is really the electroweak phase transition, the phase transition that's occurring. And it is, of course, worrying to say, well, how often does something come out of a black hole horizon? Anyway, it poses an important question, which is, how does this transition occur? Is it really something coming out of the horizon? Is there something else going on? Anyway, I have my own plans for it, but there have already been some studies that are interesting. And it may well have observable implications. I'm mentioning it because it's something I'm interested in working on. It's not because I have a concrete result. All of these ideas were just there's one extra dimension. It can certainly be elevated with warp amplifications to higher dimensions. It's just harder to draw, and there's no qualitatively different conclusion that would change what I've been talking about. There are other things that can happen in early cosmology. You can have brains floating from one side to the other. This gives rise to an idea called brain inflation, which is also being discussed in sort of the string theory context. Again, I think I was talking about it too much. So let me just give the conclusions here. These sort of warp compactifications seem to have some harmony with the kind of structures, the special features that we as theorists, when we look at sort of fundamental laws of nature, that we see. And when you try to play with these special features of what we see in the fundamental laws, you often find it's hard to account for them. But so it's striking that something like warp compactifications can address a number of interesting features of fundamental laws of nature. I don't want to pretend that it is a perfect story and therefore this must be right, because really the truth is that the puzzles, the big, big puzzles that are there in the fundamental laws to be answered, are not solved totally. Rather, they're transformed into small puzzles, which are giving us our day-to-day activity. They're not gone. It's not a perfect fit. But these ideas certainly have testable implications, and that's what's exciting. Even the discovery of the extra-dimensional excitations is a possibility in our lifetimes. And I think that's what makes this whole game exciting.
I was a little bit, that picture you had about producing the top, any top, I'm a little confused as to how we understand that picture.
Good.
Because it looks like one understands, yeah, that one there. So it looks like the one arrow I assume is on the IR brain, and the other arrow I assume is on the UV brain.
Yes.
But I thought the whole idea is to highly localize matter on one of the brains and not have much on the other. But this looks like matter is considerably stretched out for all fields.
Not only
on the brains, but in between.
Sure.
That's a very different picture.
Exactly. So I said it very quickly, but that's no excuse. Which was that I'm in some sense erasing the effects of warping to tell you what would happen in flat space time, because otherwise drawing the pictures gets even harder to see. But if you want to see what I should really have drawn, is that in some sense, what I've drawn is flat here should really have looked, say, like this. And in what sense, why did I get away with drawing it like this? Because all I was caring about was this is a boring wave function, you know, not a very fluctuating wave function, so is that. So I should have really drawn this like this, and so this would, say, be an up quark inside the proton. And then this would have been, in the case of the blue lines up there, which I again drew as boring and flat, the wave functions would look like this. And so I should have done that. In the case of these gluons, well, they are n equals 1 gluons there. But if they were n equals 0 gluons, they would look like this, which is why they're able to sort of see all these. But in the case of a Kaluza-Klein gluon, so the actual thing I've drawn, which I've just drawn weirdly, so again, I just drew this, but actually I should have drawn something which looked a bit more like this.
Okay,
but all I was distinguishing, I was not distinguishing between the exact Bessel function that this is and so on.
All right.
What I was focusing on was things without much structure at the extra dimension. Temporarily, they bang into each other and they create states which have more structure that look inside the extra dimension because they have more wiggles, and then they go back to something more again.
But, I mean, that's still quite speared out, so doesn't that mean the gravitational effects in between the brains are considerable? I mean, you've got stress energy everywhere, all over the place.
Sure.
Not only just localized on the brain, but in between.
Sure.
Except that the original picture didn't have anything in between, at least that's what I thought.
The original
picture, I thought it was Einstein vacuum everywhere except inside, everywhere except on the brain.
True. Although the back reaction, so the original picture was the picture, if you like, of the vacuum, or empty space outside the star. But these things would certainly back react in the gravitational field. It's just that let's just take something like the top quark. Okay, so if you have a top quark like this, it actually gets its mass. If it was not for the Higgs condensate, which also looks like this. If it was not propagating in the background of this condensate, it would actually be massless. So, but you can ask, so it looks like, oh, there's a nice healthy overlap of wave functions, so it looks like it's going to get some beefy mass. But the trouble is, it gets a sort of beefy mass in those sort of warped units that we have to rescale that. So it turns out that it gets a sort of exponentially small mass. And then the graviton looks like this. And roughly speaking, you can see the top quark doesn't want to talk. The top quark, as well, in particular, the Higgs condensate is more important. The mass-giving thing doesn't like talking to the graviton. Why? Because everything it gives mass to is very light. That's the way to say it. That's the explanation of why this overlap is so small. Which means that things that get mass through the Higgs condensate have a very small back reaction on the gravitational field. Another way of saying it is one top quark does not back react much on the geometry of the room. So in these pictures, the gravitational back reaction is small. But there is something very exciting though about gravity, which is even though the graviton has a wave function like this, and the Higgs condensate, you know, looks like this. Excited states of the graviton look like this. So this is sort of gravity star. And those guys do couple fairly strongly to particles of the standard model. And so they are the kind of state that you could produce at the LHC.
There's some kind of missing energy.
And these would not be, unlike sort of the very large extra dimensions,
these would not be invisible. They would not carry off missing energy, because the same thing that, so the same thing that allows you to produce the fact that these couplings, the coupling of ordinary matter is strong, allows them to decay strongly. And so you would actually see the energy that was, this would just show up as a bump in the cross section or something. This is distinct, again, from larger extra dimensions, where there's in fact a whole, there are very, very many kinematically accessible graviton excitations. Each one has a minuscule coupling, but there's so many channels that you produce them. But once any one single one of them is produced, that particular one won't want to decay, because the amplitude is the same. So that's a distinct scenario. But these would be visible spin two. They might, my studies would suggest that they would be on the outside of each that we see, at least in the scenario that I talked about.
What happens to the warp accuracy of more than one extra dimension? And these are not direct products, but it's very close to nothing.
Yeah, so the kind of setting in which all of this would still go through, which does readily solve Einstein's equations under some robust circumstances, is when you have the you have the geometry I already gave, so the 5D, and it is a cross-product. So the 5D is warped. Okay, it's a 5D warped geometry across some extra dimension, whatever, it's all the sixth dimensions. But where it is a cross-product, it's a fractalized geometry, then everything goes through, and that is something that is easily arranged. It doesn't require some terrible thing to get solutions of that sort. So in that sense, that's why in string theory these warp geometries can play very similar roles to everything I've talked about, even though string theories typically have another five dimensions on top of these.
Okay, but if it's not a direct product, then I guess something goes wrong with this warp.
Yeah, well, in particular, what can go wrong? And I think, I don't know any case where it doesn't, is that the huge exponential redshifting effects that you're using don't stay exponential. They turn into some power law, and the power of this whole approach is greatly diminished.
You're mentioning what gravitational waves underneath her, what type of frequency ranges from the gravitational waves would be coming in, and if you think that Lisa could detect it, what type of?
So in fact, this is one of the things where it's embarrassing. I'm behind the times in this, in that this phase transition is, to me, by far and away the most exciting thing that I have not understood. So to me, it's really way too in advance, in my view, to talk about gravitational waves. And now, I write it because it is, that's why I put a question mark. There's always fine print about it. But I put a question mark because I don't know whether to believe it or not. Well, I've asked one expert on the subject. In fact, this guy here, Copus, and his view is this story that they're telling about gravitational waves from this transition, it is plausible, it's not like it's ridiculous, but you are so sensitive to details of this transition, which are not yet being perfectly well understood, that he agrees it's premature to go around predicting. So the answers to your question are extremely sensitive to details that I think you would have to be very hopeful to say. And I think they're being very hopeful about it.
But are you essentially saying that some type of black holes are in fact sort of coming from this compactification, which you're giving rise to these gravitational waves, or you can have a whole galaxy or galactic clusters, which could be an offshoot of such warp case?
No, there's enough that at the level of
You mean like black holes that are in our, you know, macroscopic black holes? No, they are not in any way connected to, you know, the black brain that I was talking to before. They would have to have some entirely astrophysical origins, which would not depend so much on the details of this. Gravitational waves would certainly not be so big as the cave in the journey of a black hole.
Maybe this is a good time to take it offline. I think Robin has had it to be adjusted in the Easter over in the later afternoon. So else wants to have no questions. And she thanked everyone for a very clear talk.